It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk about why Wisconsin is lagging behind the rest of the nation when it comes to women-owned businesses.
First, Wisconsin-based home improvement giant Menards settled a labor dispute yesterday with the National Labor Relations Board. The case stems from complaints that the company's employment agreements allegedly violated employee rights.
In just a moment, we'll be joined by Marquette Law Professor Paul Secunda about the impact of the decision on labor law. First, Rich Kramer joins us, WPR News reporter. He's covering this story. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Rich, what prompted this labor dispute?
Well, there was a complaint filed by the Office and Professional Employees International Union, Local 153, that's based in New York. But basically, the complaint alleged that Menards was requiring employees to sign mandatory arbitration agreements. These kept workers from being able to engage in class action lawsuits or collective actions against the company. And there was another this was the major point, but another one was that the Menards company handbook stated that workers would not get merit-based raises if they engaged in certain protected unionization activities.
So this went before the National Labor Relations Board. And this is a settlement. This wasn't imposed, but there was the risk from Menards' point of view of a settlement being imposed on them. So what did Menards agree to do to settle this today?
They basically said that they would change their company policies. They would stop requiring the workers to sign this mandatory arbitration waiver. And they also would change the company handbook so that employees wouldn't be penalized for engaging in these unionization activities, one of which I thought was interesting. Employees would not get merit raises if they engaged in gossiping, which I guess is a protected union activity.
Now, the settlement has been reached. Have we heard comment either from the union that brought this to the National Labor Relations Board or from Menards itself?
Menards has not commented. I reached out this morning. There was also a press attempts yesterday evening to get comment from the company, and they have not done that. But the union says it's a major victory for workers. They say that this, especially from a company like Menards, which is pretty well known for being anti-union or working to try to stifle union activities, it's a major step forward.
Well, Rich, thanks for bringing us up to date on this.
Thanks for having me.
Now we'll bring on Law Professor Paul Secunda into the discussion. Paul is Director of Labor and Employment Law at Marquette University Law School. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again. Always a pleasure.
Well, the SEIU, the union behind this, one of their representatives told Progressive Magazine that this decision, this settlement, was historic. Is this a big deal, do you think, in terms of labor relations?
I think it is because of the size of Menards. It operates more than 280 stores in 14 states. It has 45,000 workers that were subject to these employment policies, these employee handbooks. And basically, they're admitting that their anti-union stances were not consistent with what labor law requires. That's something you don't see every day.
This mandatory arbitration, the idea that collective actions couldn't be taken as part of, I guess, what employees had to sign to work there, is this something that's common in other businesses?
It's increasingly common. More and more companies, especially large companies, are having employees put into mandatory arbitration programs that says that to the extent that they have any type of dispute with their employer, they agree to arbitrate those claims, either individually or, more controversially, even when they have a class action. The reason that's problematic is because Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act protects concerted activity for mutual aid and protection. And by not allowing employees to work together to improve their workplace with or without litigation, they're interfering with those labor rights.
Is this going to make it more difficult for other companies to do this? Will we see similar challenges to similar mandatory arbitration agreements?
They're already ongoing. And in fact, interestingly enough, the various trial courts and appellate courts that have heard these challenges are divided. Some support the NLRB's views that this is a violation of labor law. The Fifth Circuit down in Texas has taken the view that this is not violative of the labor law. I think this is heading to the Supreme Court of the United States because what we have is a split of authority among different courts. So this will eventually have to be decided decisively by the United States Supreme Court.
Paul, can you step back a bit and tell us what goes to a national relations or national labor relations board versus what just goes through the court system? What happens in each sphere of our system?
Sure. The National Labor Relations Board has primary jurisdiction over issues that come up under the National Labor Relations Act. That is the federal labor law that regulates private sector labor relations. So anything dealing with organizing, joining, assisting a union, collective bargaining, forming a collective bargaining agreement between a union and an employer, or any other type of what we call protected activities, which could include strikes, lockouts, boycotts, pickets, this is under the primary jurisdiction, which means the NLRB has the first crack because of their expertise and their experience in labor law. Usually by the time it gets to federal courts is as an appellate matter. That is, it's being appealed from the decision of the National Labor Relations Board to one of the appellate courts somewhere in the country, which is reviewing the decisions of the National Labor Relations Board.
Rich mentioned this other change that was made by Menards, the company, in this settlement. A company policy saying if you participated in collective activity or, I guess, trying to start a union, basically, you would not be eligible for merit raises. This doesn't meet national labor laws?
Well, the problem is that the various language, and Rich also mentioned that you couldn't have a questionable attitude or you couldn't gossip.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty harmless, but in fact, what has happened over the years is that employers have used that vague, arbitrary language to kind of ferret out union supporters, using those terms in order to get rid of the most active union members. And so what the National Labor Relations Board has said is, if you're going to have these policies, disciplinary policies in your employee handbooks, they have to be specific and cannot in any way chill potential union activity. So the concern here is that this merit pay eligibility notice that existed in the previous employee handbook with this language was chilling potential protected union activity from some of these employees.
Big picture, what's the balance these days in, say, a big retail chain like Menards versus collective bargaining rights? We've seen that swing up and down over the years, haven't we?
We have, and right now labor is struggling because of the types of workforce that they have. They tend to be transient. They're low paid. They're more concerned about making sure they get their paycheck as opposed to standing up for their rights and having voice in the workplace. So this is a significant win for the unions and these retail employees they seek to represent, because in the last few years, the number of employees who are either in unions or seeking to unionize in these retail industries has been declining.
Who's in charge of the National Labor Relations Board? Who appoints the members of that board?
The members of the board, of which there are five, are appointed by the president. And by practice, there are three members from the president's party and two members from the opposing party. So right now, if the board were full, it would have three Democrats and two Republicans. In fact, there's only four members on the National Labor Relations Board because of the political nature. And in August, we'll be dropping down to three. Three is the minimum number of people who can be on the board and still do business. There was a recent Supreme Court case that has said when you get down to two members, the National Labor Relations Board no longer has a quorum and no longer can hear cases.
Well, speaking of shorthanded boards, the Supreme Court itself is down one member. If a case like this went to the Supreme Court, we might well see a tied vote there.
Well, absolutely. We just saw that in the Friedrichs case dealing with so-called fair share fees with public sector unions. If Justice Scalia had lived a little longer, it's very possible that public sector unions could have taken a significant blow with regard to their ability to collect union fees. Of course, that case ended up 4-4, which led to the Ninth Circuit's decision upholding the practice being reinstated. Similarly, in these types of cases concerning labor rights, the Ninth Justice could be extremely decisive because you do have a division between those justices who tend to side with business and those justices who tend to side with the workers.
And Paul, as we wrap up, this Menards settlement we're hearing about today, it was a settlement. It wasn't an order imposed by the National Labor Relations Board. Does that mean it doesn't really set a precedent, or is this a board that doesn't really work based on precedent?
Well, first of all, it is a settlement, so it only applies to the parties who have signed the agreement, the NLRB and Menards. However, you're correct that the NLRB does not work like a normal judicial court in the sense that precedent is only followed to the extent that it is still consistent with existing labor relations. And because labor relations changes from decade to decade, the labor law changes from decade to decade. One obvious example would be with the use of social media. The labor laws had to change to deal with the use of social media for organizing and collective bargaining purposes. And so there's not as much emphasis put on previous case law when labor relations has changed in the workplace.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
That's Marquette Law School Professor Paul Secunda and WPR reporter Rich Kramer joined us earlier. We've been talking about the labor settlement between home improvement giant Menards and the National Labor Relations Board. A recent study finds a lot of room for improvement in Wisconsin when it comes to women-owned businesses.
American Express analyzed 2015 census data looking at women-owned firms in each state. And Wisconsin ranked 38th nationally, and we also trail every state in the upper Midwest.
State economists say the ranking isn't too surprising since Wisconsin is traditionally at the back of the pack when it comes to entrepreneurship in general.
Heather Wendler joins us now to talk about women-owned businesses in Wisconsin. She's co-founder of the Doyen Group and the founder of Fractal. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, why do you think Wisconsin tends to lag behind when it comes to women-owned businesses?
I think there's a lot of different reasons as to why we lag behind. I do want to also highlight this is the first year we've made gains in this report. Previously, we had gone down over the past 3 years to last year we were tied for last place. So being up to the 38th spot is actually a great improvement this year.
So it sounds as though the picture, it could be emerging, could be there's some sort of evolution happening here. We're still lagging, you know, especially in the upper Midwest. So how would you characterize how Wisconsin, what the climate is like here for women entrepreneurs?
I would, you know, I definitely think there's a lot of different factors that go into looking at how and why women start businesses here within our state. They also, you know, when they are putting together this report, they're looking at the census data. And a lot of the ways that the data is taken within the census hasn't been updated as far as how businesses are founded or what's considered a woman-owned business and what's considered a male-owned business. So there's, you know, based on what we're seeing, there's probably a lot more women-owned businesses than what are actually being reported on because of the way that data is being taken.
So it sounds like you're more optimistic than the number suggests.
Yeah, you know, they really, last year they said that 2014 was the year of women entrepreneurs, and we are seeing really high growth and steady gains within the businesses that are being formed and growing within Wisconsin.
Well, looking around the country, are there places that we could look to for models if we want to keep the numbers growing?
Yes. So that's one area that Doyen is really working on. It's trying to find, you know, that quote unquote secret sauce as to what makes a great community for women to start their businesses. And, you know, looking at the areas right now, New York is ranking in first place for the number of women-led businesses within that area. But then also looking at within our region, you know, Chicago ranks number 4. And then if you're looking at that economic clout that the report talks a lot about, and so the clout looks at the number of businesses being started, the number or the dollars of revenue they're bringing in, the number of employees that they have. You know, we have Indianapolis and Detroit also being within that top 10. Plus, I was making huge gains as far as women starting and growing their businesses. So there's different areas that are doing, you know, accelerator programs that are focusing just on women started businesses and kind of the needs and some of the challenges that women are facing. But then it's how do we start having a larger conversation of changing the context of how businesses are looked at from an outsider, from an investment standpoint, and, you know, just overall as to what benefits everyone.
Assuming that there is still some work to do, even at 38, there's room for upward mobility there. What do you think could be holding women back in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's still, I think some of it, you know, is, you know, that the way that business is perceived, the way that business is handled, So we still get a lot of talk about there being glass ceilings for women trying to get into those leadership roles, being taken seriously in the boardroom or in those executive offices. Those are still huge hurdles that women are trying to overcome. And still, you know, because of those are some reasons why women are more tentative when they go into starting their business and kind of thinking about what they want their business to look like and what scale they want to take their business to. So a lot of women say, you know, if I can just do this so it's making enough money for me and maybe I'll bring in, you know, 2 to 3 more people so I can have a nice staff. That is, you know, a big goal for a lot of women starting their business. And it's, you know, that's great. I think that's amazing that they want to do that. But how do we make sure that women that are saying, you know, I want to build the next, you know, unicorn company and take it huge and sell it to, you know, Google or Facebook or something like that. How do we make sure that those avenues and areas of support are open for them to be able to do that as well?
Are you saying that there's an ambition gap for women, that women assume they can't achieve, you know, the status of an Amazon or a Netflix? Or are you saying they want to do it, but the avenues aren't there?
I'm saying that they want to do it, but they're still feeling like some of the avenues aren't there, or there's more of a hesitation. I think some of it also goes back to a lot of the societal norms that women face. I think we're still kind of overcoming this, as much as I hate to say it, but women being seen as they should be in the kitchen and raising the kids. And so, you know, women that are going into investor pitch opportunities, you know, are being faced with, well, this is great, but who's your male counterpart? Or you need to bring in, you know, Mr. MBA or someone else to help you show that you can do this. Or how are you going to have kids and still be able to run your business? These are all questions that women are being asked and their male counterparts aren't necessarily being asked when they are building and scaling their businesses.
We're talking with Heather Wendler right now, executive director and co-founder of Doyen Group Incorporated, as we talk about why Wisconsin still has a fair bit of room for growth when it comes to women-owned businesses. We are 38th right now nationally, and we trail every state in the upper Midwest. And Heather, let's talk about Doyen. This is a group that you founded to do just the sort of thing that you're describing here, support women-owned businesses, enable them, give them tools. What is the mission of Doyen? How would you describe it?
So the overall vision of Doyen is to make, you know, Madison and Wisconsin one of the top regions within the country for women entrepreneurs to start and scale their businesses. So we provide support through mentoring, workshops, and developmental opportunities that are really tailored to the individual. So it's not a one size fits all. It's not a, you're going to come and to our programming and learn about this one skill and then walk away and go back to your business going, that was great. Now, how do I do this? You know, it's more of my co-founder and I both come from the education. We have education backgrounds. And so working with our students, we know that just standing up in front of a room, telling people how to do things doesn't really work. And so we take that more of an individual approach of, here's a good idea, but here's how we really flesh it out. And then along with that, we're also starting our Evergreen Fund. So right now we're in the middle of fundraising for our Evergreen Fund to start being able to put dollars into the hands of women entrepreneurs to help them launch and grow their businesses.
And you are obviously working hands-on with a lot of these new businesses. Can you tell us a story or two about a new business that has taken off?
Yeah, so we have a lot of great success stories coming out from around the state. One of my favorites that we have is a woman named Alyssa Totananu, who started Feline Studio and American Skillet Company. And when she first came, she actually first came to my husband and I about 5 years ago with, I want to make these state-shaped cast iron skillets. And we helped her with that. We helped her look at the business model and how to scale it to a point where now she was featured on Martha Stewart. Her pans are being, you know, sold nationally. And she's seen a lot of growth within both of her companies. You know, another one that we've had is called Flavor Temptations. And when they were first starting, both her and her husband were pivoting out of their full-time jobs to start this ethnic spicery business. And they were packaging it in their, you know, in their industrial kitchen, or yeah, their kitchen on the weekends, and taking them out to store or grocery stores to sell them, to now they're working with a distribution line and our regional product within multiple different grocery stores across the Midwest.
Well, as we began the interview, you said you're kind of more optimistic than the numbers indicate right now. But what would you, if you could, just briefly as we wrap up here, if you could speak to legislators and business owners, what do you want from the state for support?
Yeah, I really think we need to relook at how we take this data in, and it needs to be updated. And how do we start making those changes so that women are being recognized as business owners, and how do we put more visibility around the support that we really need to be able to take our businesses to the next level?
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Heather Wendler is the co-founder of the Doyen Group, and she joined us to talk about Wisconsin's climate for women-owned businesses.
Car culture swept across the United States a century or so ago, led by Henry Ford's famous Model T.
There's one car that takes you anywhere you want to go, the Model T. Strong, sturdy, with a will of its own.
Now the Model T's descendants and the transportation system built around them are part of the landscape, and our next guest says we take it for granted and overlook the costs.
In his new book, he examines the transportation world that shapes our lives, often without us noticing it, and the way we move humans around and the way we move the stuff humans consume around the nation. Edward Humes is an author and journalist. His newest book is Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. Edward, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, Edward, you cover a lot of ground in this book. I want to start with cars. Do we take the current state of affairs, our really car-focused culture, for granted in the United States?
Oh, I think so. And we don't have much perspective on it. One of the things I looked at is just what the toll on us is of our driving. And we drive about, 340 million miles an hour here. 340 million miles covered in an hour of American driving, and during that process, people are being injured serious enough to go to the emergency room every 12 seconds. And that huge toll, we're rather blasé about it. If you look at the deaths in a year on the road, it's like having four full airliners crash every week. But we seem to think it's just a matter of how it's done, that's the price to pay for getting around. And what I found out is it's not. They're almost all preventable.
Yeah, you write that if there's a car defect that causes deaths, even a relatively small number of deaths, this is a big deal, major lawsuits, major recalls. But this daily attrition that dwarfs the amount of that kind of an injury or death is just part of our background noise for people you write, except unless you're involved in an accident or you're involved, if you're in the police or the ambulance that deals with that accident.
Well, part of the psychology of driving, and I guess I'm as guilty of this as anyone, is that it's everybody else's the problem, never the person who's doing the driving. It's like the old George Carlin joke, everyone who's going slower than me is an idiot, and everyone who's going faster than me is a maniac. But I'm doing it right. But that's deceptive. And a lot of the things that we do behind the wheel routinely are exactly the things that get us killed.
And you said to use the word preventable. Almost all of these would be preventable. If that's true, and if we know how to do it, why aren't we preventing this?
Well, you used the term car culture in the intro, and we have literally evolved a culture around our transportation that, by design, kills 38,000 people a year. We've designed it to do that. It's the expected result, and it's, of course, it's all preventable. A third of them are from drunken driving. We have in hand very simple technology now that can prevent drunk drivers from starting a car. We don't deploy it except in very small numbers. We have technology that, like cruise control, could limit people from exceeding the speed limit. We already have smartphones that give us all the information we need to accomplish that, but we seem to think we have an inalienable right to drive at speeds that are unsafe. That's another third of deaths on the highway, speeding. And the last part is distraction. We all think we can do about five things at once while we're driving, eating, texting, whatever. But our brains really aren't good at that. We can do one thing well at a time. And distraction is the other big piece of the puzzle. And there's plenty of technology that could prevent us from manipulating our cell phones except by voice command while in a moving car, but we don't deploy that either. We could prevent all these accidents.
Talking to Edward Humes, his new book is Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. Edward, we'll get back in the car in a little bit, but your book isn't just about cars. You spend a lot of time looking at what you say is, in a lot of ways, almost a completely invisible part of our transportation system, the ways we get our stuff from ports to our local store and into our houses. Why do we not see all this happening?
Well, it's all the stuff, you know, we obsess on our commutes, but that's really, in some ways, the smallest part of our transportation footprint in terms of the actual miles. There's millions of miles of transport embedded in our daily lives. You know, with the cup of coffee I drank this morning, it took 30,000 miles to get those beans, that blend of beans, to my home. You know, my smartphone's got, a trip to the moon in miles. My car, 30,000 globally sourced parts moving in this vast choreography between countries back and forth, turning into assemblies, turning into larger components, and finally turning into a car that's made 12,000 miles away. Now we're talking 500,000 miles of transportation before the odometer clicks a single mile with me driving it. So each one of our products, each of the things we take for granted in our lives has this huge infrastructure embedded in it, and that's growing all the time. E-commerce is making it grow all the time.
You have a quote that I love in the book about kind of the invisibility of that that transportation that gets us the stuff we use. A hearing about whether or not to build a port in a community to bring stuff into the country, and one person attending said, "Why do I need a port? I have Walmart."
Exactly.
So talk about that. Talk about that. That sense of stuff's just at Walmart. Where did it come from?
Well, and that's the perception that it somehow magically appears inside a store for us to go buy it. But, of course, that's not the case. Almost all the goods that Walmart sells to us came in to the country on a giant container ship through a port. From the port, it gets on a train. From the train, it gets on a truck. Every product that you touch in your home has been on a truck at one or more points along the line. And all of that and more is required to bring a pair of socks or a smartphone or anything else you can think of to us. And that's great. I mean, we've built this. It is magnificent. It's a huge achievement to be able to do what we do, this art of logistics. It may be humanity's most enormous achievement, but at the same time, we don't want to really pay the true cost of it. We want to click on that buy it now and have our product magically appear, but we also can't stand to have trucks on the road. We can't stand to pay taxes in order to keep that transportation system intact, and we have a huge backlog on that score. So, you know, we want it both ways, but since we're not actually picking up the tab, we're headed towards a somewhat dire fork in the road.
Well, getting back to cars, you write that, you know, in 100 years or so, we've gone from Zeppelins to a high-tech aircraft managed with incredible air traffic control systems. Computers have revolutionized, management of the ports, Amazon's logistics, things like that. And yet, when we get behind the wheel of a car, we're in something that's not much more than a glorified Model T. Why so little progress in cars compared to everything else?
It's the only thing we still measure in horsepower. You know, even the dimensions of a car, as they conventionally exist now, are based on the width of a two horse drawn cart.
Right. Our cars are about 6 feet wide. You're right, and that came from the width of a horse cart.
Exactly, and in so many ways, it's still an industrial age, 19th century technology with a lot of fancy computer chips and safety features bolted on top of it. But it's still that Model T model is still what we're driving around. Even the efficiency of it hasn't changed much in terms of the ratio of fuel that moves the car versus energy that's wasted. It's barely moved the needle. And 80 cents out of the dollar you spend on gasoline is literally wasted. Doesn't move the car. It's inefficiency incarnate.
So why? We're advancing all these other things, but in many ways our cars are stuck in neutral, historically speaking. What is it about the cars that have made us, I mean, they've changed a lot, safety features, radios, to things like that, but why have they moved so slowly compared to everything else in our technology?
we love them. I mean, they are such a huge part of our lives, everything from rite of passage in our youth, getting that driver's license, to, you know, being hauled away in a very shiny black hearse. That the other cars are integrated into our lives in ways that are beyond the rational and are really part of our way of life. And like a lot of things that are so a part of our daily existence, we don't question them anymore. We don't ask, why does it have to be this? Why do we champion this, what Morgan Stanley calls the most underutilized asset in our daily lives, the car, because it sits by the curb 22 or more hours out of a day. It's like having a worker who puts in a 14-hour work week but gets full pay. Our cars are just, in so many ways, really insane in terms of their lack of safety, in terms of their impact on the environment, in terms of their cost versus the return on investment. And yet, if they're convenient, they're at our beck and call, and it's just the way it's been now for 100 years. So we are clinging to a very old model when almost everything else in our lives has been revolutionized.
We're talking to Edward Humes. His new book is Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think we rely on cars too much in the United States? What alternatives do you think we should be pursuing? Or do you think the convenience of cars is worth the cost of the things our guest is describing? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about car culture in America and the costs we pay for it. Edward Humes is our guest. He's the author of the book Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation.
Call now at 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Do we rely too much on cars, on roads in the United States? Should we invest more in alternatives? What alternatives, if so? Or do you want all our transportation money going to cars? That's the convenient way. That's the thing we use. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have an excerpt from the book, by the way, linked there. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I agree with the statement completely. We agree or rely on cars too much. We get all of our food from cross country, whether it be using semi trucks or trains. People live out of town to drive, and they drive into work. So it's like if one of the legs goes away, we're kind of you know, out of luck. You know, you're not going to be able to get to work if your car is broken. If you know the cost of fuel rises too much, people might not ship the products, and then you know shelves are going out empty. We don't like rely on local, you know, food sources, and people don't live really close to their jobs anymore. They rely on their cars.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. Edward, he brings up a lot there. Maybe the core point that we've really designed our lives, our whole society around cars, given how we've built things, isn't it going to be kind of hard to wean ourselves away from what we've got now?
It is. And you know, the answer really isn't to condemn cars and to do away with them. That's not going to work because, as you say, we've built a world that we live in that makes them extremely valuable. So maybe it's the way that we use and deploy cars, not the cars themselves, that are a big part of the problem. Look at the lessons of ride-sharing, of Lyft and Uber and those companies in that space. Now they've changed the dynamic for cars. Instead of owning your car, you buy time in it, and then it goes off and takes somebody somewhere else. You can do much more with a single vehicle when you have a share service. Now if you add the up-and-coming technology of driverless cars to that, now suddenly you have a really interesting scenario where car ownership might fade, and you could sort of buy travel time like you buy minutes on your smartphone. And it doesn't have to be the jack-of-all-trades cars that we drive now. You could have purpose-built cars that are part of a shared fleet, maybe one- and two-passenger vehicles, larger ones for larger loads. And you have the added safety of a robot driving your car that never drinks, gets distracted, or speeds. That would revolutionize personal transport and solve what we call the last mile, first mile problem. People don't take transit, mass transit, or trains much because it's so inconvenient to get to the station. A fleet of shared driverless cars solves that problem, picks you up to the door, takes you to the station.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Getting back to that, the basic layout of our lives, there's almost a culture war element in it. It seems like sometimes when you start going for more, bike-friendly or pedestrian-friendly roads or streets or mass transit. I mean, when you look at the late Rob Ford's election as mayor of Toronto, a lot of his campaign was on saving the car in some ways. High-speed rail was an issue in elections here in Wisconsin. This is a touchy subject when you start trying to change things.
It is. It always is. And that's why it's necessary to compromise. Why, we've invested a lot in transit plans, mass transit trains, light rail, and so forth around the country, different communities. And it oftentimes has failed to reduce traffic. And that's an important lesson. There's a lot of good reasons to have public transit available, but if we expect it to solve our traffic problems, we're going to be continually disappointed. I think the real solution is to make the various forms of transportation mesh together and give people more choices for how they get around, so you don't have to be utterly dependent on a car or utterly dependent on some other form of transportation. And frankly, the other thing Americans need to start thinking about is we walk less than any other developed nation in the world. We seem to hate walking more than any other country, and it's almost weird, and it's a new development. Kids don't walk to school anymore. Most of the trips we take during the day, half of them are 3 miles or less, and yet we get in our car and drive for almost all of them. So there's something about our culture, and maybe it's no coincidence we're also one of the more obese nations around, that we just have stopped walking. And that's something that is going to take some effort to look at and change, but perhaps it's something we need to pay more attention to.
Talking to Edward Humes about his new book, Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. Back to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Fall River. John, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, is it worth all the extra money that we have to shell out with these new cars? You know, like, for instance, if your oil pan rusted out on these new cars, it can be $800 to $1,000. You got to pull the engine. That was never the case years ago. Mechanical fuel pump was bolted right on the engine block, and that was like $25. You could change that out in 10 minutes versus this electric fuel pump, $400 to $600. Shock absorbers versus struts, it just goes on and on. Where's our electric car that they've been talking about for 50, 60 years?
John, thanks a lot for the call. So talk about hidden costs, hidden personal costs in a way when we think, the cost of buying the car, the cost of fuel, repair costs can sneak up on us. It may be making less sense, I guess he's saying, Edward, for our personal economies to be a car owner.
Yeah, no, a car is the second most expensive family cost next to your housing. It's huge. I put together some figures that if you account for all costs, including repair, insurance, and depreciation, we pay about $12,500 a year for a car. Again, a car that sits by the curb 22, 23 hours out of the day. If you have an SUV, you can tack another $2,000 on top of that $12,500. So it's a really expensive investment, and I agree, they've become more complex, and the age of the backyard weekend mechanic that I grew up with is kind of passe for modern vehicles, and the solution there again maybe is the mechanical simplicity of an electric car. They have far less parts, they're far more efficient, and we seem to be solving the problem of range. Every year they are more effective, and if we share them in the sort of driverless car future that a lot of people are envisioning, EVs make even more sense, because most trips we take are short trips, and you don't need a long-range vehicle for most of them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Edward, I don't want to get away from this without getting to the local street. You write about how anything that's a road or a street is really car-focused. You say to allow more modes of transportation, get us out walking more, we need to rethink that local street as more than just an avenue for cars. How do we do that?
Well, not all traffic is bad. When in the sort of Main Street area where you have a mix of shoppers and walkers and bicyclists and cars, traffic congestion is a good thing. It's a sign of economic activity, because those streets are primarily not to get from point A to B, but they are builders of wealth. That's what local streets are supposed to be for. Everything else, the roads and highways, those are about getting from point A to point B as fast as we can, and that's where we want traffic to flow smoothly. What we don't want to do is try and make hybrids out of it and have them be the best of both worlds, because invariably they'll be the worst of both worlds. And we, the name I've heard of that from an organization called Strong Towns is STRODES, you know, a combination of street and road, and they just don't work well. That's where most of the accidents happen. And we have gotten into sort of developing that way. That also requires some rethinking, you know, either a road or a street, but don't try to be both.
Edward, briefly as we wrap up, do you see an appetite in our culture to rethink the way we use our cars, the way we invest in infrastructure?
Oh, absolutely. And we see the trends. There's in poll after poll of the millennial generation and younger who are less entranced with having their own cars as generations passed and more interested in mobility by any means. You know, what they are big users of apps that put together travel itineraries for them that get them where they want to go, whether it's on the bus or the train or in a ride share or in their own car. They just want to get there, and they don't care how. And that's very promising for the future.
We'll leave it there. Edward, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to Edward Humes. His newest book is called Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. Still time to share your thoughts on what he has to say on the role of the car in American culture, for good or for bad. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know what you think over there. And by the way, we've got a link to an excerpt from his book focused on cars in particular that is linked at the Central Time Facebook page. And remember, if you want to share your thoughts in 140 characters or less, you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Love to hear what's on your mind.
Faster than a speeding bullet.
And halt. Smash.
A very brief survey there of the vast world of superheroes. We heard Superman, the Avengers, and everyone's favorite alien kids, the Wonder Twins.
All of them are being celebrated today on National Superhero Day. The event was started in the 1990s by Marvel Comics employees, in part to celebrate their creations, but also to get out into the community and celebrate real-life everyday heroes.
And of course, it raises the eternal question, if you could have a superpower, which one would you want and why? And not all of them.
Oh, you're asking me?
You get one, Veronica.
I don't know. I have to get
or
more
two.
Than one.
Okay, I'll give you two.
So I've been thinking about this because this is a deep question. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would go with something like Kung Fu Superhero. If I could do really amazing Kung Fu where I could flip off things and spiral through the air.
Like Matrix-y type stuff or Crouching Tiger,
or,
Hidden Dragon,
that's
Wire
more what
type.
I was thinking.
Yeah, more graceful. Yeah. That would be super cool. I hate to go with the obvious. Flying would be a lot of fun if I can have the secondary superpower of invulnerable to motion sickness, because otherwise I'm not taking that flying thing.
I don't know if that's a superpower or just more a matter of like taking a pill.
Yeah, well, in Batman too. Is he a superhero? He just has a lot of his money and stuff.
He's got a lot of cool gadgets going on for him.
All right. Okay. Super gadgets. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.